Good afternoon. 12:07 in the p.m. You're listening to KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Well, there's still a few good people in Congress. Dennis Kucinich is trying to do something. This is from rawstory.com. A House committee subpoenas Federal Reserve. The congressional panel investigating what happened to all that bank bailout money has issued a subpoena to the Federal Reserve, asking them to hand over all documents relating to the takeover of Merrill Lynch by the Bank of America. On January 1st, Bank of America finalized its purchase of Merrill Lynch for just over $29 billion. This made the bank eligible for an additional $20 billion in federal rescue money, bringing Bank of America's total to some $45 billion. Now, Representative Kucinich of Ohio and Adolphus Towns of New York want to know exactly what the banks and the Federal Reserve agreed to when they arranged the deal last year. This is the full text of the press release from Kucinich's office. House Oversight and Government Reform Committee Chairman Adolphus Towns and Ranking Member Daryl Issa of California today served a subpoena on the Federal Reserve to compel it to turn over documents related to Bank of America's acquisition of Merrill Lynch. The full committee and domestic policy subcommittee under the leadership of Kucinich has been investigating the circumstances surrounding the federal government's bailout of the Bank of America Merrill Lynch transaction. Specific documents subpoenaed include emails, notes of conversations, and other documents. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has claimed that in 2008, then-Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke strong-armed Bank of America into buying Merrill, a move that, if true, could expose Paulson and Bernanke to prosecution. My comment, fat chance. On with the communique. Last week, news services reported that the House had asked Bank of America CEO Kenneth Lewis to testify before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. My comment, will we ever hear the results of this inquiry, or will it be kept secret in the interests of national security? My next question, exactly whose security is national security? My commentary for today, June 17th. A listener sent me an interesting YouTube video. In it, a man was demonstrating... Oh, darn. Okay, this isn't what I wrote, but oh well. A listener sent me an interesting YouTube video. In it, a man was demonstrating that the iron in some fortified breakfast cereals was actually iron filings. Yes, tiny pieces of the metal iron. The demonstrator opened a sealed box of an unnamed breakfast cereal, shook some of the flakes into a blender, added water, and blended it into a slurry. When he put the slurry in a plastic bag and put a magnet on the outside of the bag, sure enough, iron filings collected next to the magnet. I suppose when chemically tested, yeah, the cereal was fortified with iron. But unfortunately for consumers, that form of iron is not really useful to the body and could even be harmful. Would you willingly swallow iron filings? The website added that the reason it is added in a form you can extract with a magnet is that iron that would more easily combine with other molecules in the cereal, increase the spoilage rate of the food. Using iron in its pure metal form gives the cereal a longer shelf life. Ah, capitalism. Ain't it grand? Next item. Ever wonder why some of the women prisoners in Abu Ghraib sent messages to their relatives to please kill them, as they could not stand what they were enduring while in captivity? Well, perhaps some of the photos and videos that Obama has decided not to release may contain some of the answers. According to Seymour Hersh, a very experienced and well-respected journalist, some of the videos contained horrific footage of rape and sodomy, not only of female and male prisoners, but of children. The Muslim world has very harsh ideas concerning the purity of women. If any Arab woman is raped, she's defiled, and if unmarried, it's next to impossible for her to find a husband. If she is married, her husband may choose to divorce her, as she's been tarnished. Unfair? Barbaric? Certainly. But that is their belief system, like it or not. So for any Arab woman imprisoned by the Americans, her life might be as good as over, even after her release. She probably can't find anyone to marry her, and if married, she may be cast away by divorce and unable to find someone else to remarry. The Arab belief system punishes the rape victim far more than the perpetrator. Ever wonder why some Arab women might volunteer to be suicide bombers? The miracle is that more of them don't choose that path. What else is there for them to do? Next item. Let's talk about Afghanistan. Outside of the few major cities and towns, Afghanistan is a nation of poor farmers. Forget for the moment that in most of the world, opium is illegal. In Afghanistan, it's the leading cash crop. If you were an Afghan farmer, what would you choose to grow, onions or opium poppies? It's a no-brainer, right? It doesn't mean that these farmers are drug users, only that they will grow whatever sells best. Latest figures reported by either the UN or the U.S. government, I'm not sure which, are that 60% of Afghanistan's gross national product comes from opium production. Now, last time I heard, there's a war going on over there, so I'm a bit curious how some bean counters arrived at that figure. But since Afghanistan doesn't produce anything else to speak of, I think it's reasonable to assume that most of the money coming into Afghanistan comes from the opium trade. It's been reported the Taliban is supporting the farmers by giving them seed, fertilizer, protection, and when the crop comes in, purchasing and marketing their crop. All of this is extremely helpful to the farmers. Meanwhile, the Americans and their puppet government in Kabul are harassing these same farmers and oftentimes destroying their crops, which to them are not drugs, it's their livelihood. The opium crop is how they feed their families. Now, snap quiz. One group helps the farmers to feed their families. The rival group hinders and harasses them. Whom do you think Afghan farmers are likely to prefer? Since Afghan merchants are dependent on doing business with the farmers, whom do you think they will end up supporting? Not for philosophic reasons, but for practical feed-your-family reasons. Yet another example of winning the hearts and minds of the Afghans. Obama's policies in Afghanistan are a continuation of the same dumb, short-sighted policies of the Bush-Cheney clique. Way to go, troops. But we're going to win in Afghanistan. Sure we are. Next item. I continually find it interesting how corporate media manages the news. I listened to NPR News yesterday, and they told me that the important stories of the day were a labor dispute at the Boston Globe, an exciting story on whether NASA would fly some mission or have it postponed for maybe a week because a fuel line was leaking. And then there was the latest dust-up between India and Pakistan. I forgot the issue. Does it matter? What NPR forgot to report on was the battle in Congress as we speak over whether Congress will listen to its constituents and at least consider single-payer health care, or instead will listen to its major contributors and vote for a continuation of the health care insurance ripoff. As far as corporate media is concerned, the only sensible solution to your health care miseries is a non-item. Forget about it. If you don't agree, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is bucking the tide and trying to do something. Here is his email press release. A petition to Congress. Supporting single-payer health care. Our current private health care insurance system is the most costly, wasteful, complicated, and bureaucratic in the world. Today, 46 million people have no health insurance. Even more are underinsured with high deductibles and co-payments. Close to 20,000 Americans die each year because they don't have regular access to a doctor. The time is now for our nation to address the most profound moral and economic issue we face. The time is now for our country to join the rest of the industrialized world and provide cost-effective, comprehensive, quality health care to every man, woman, and child in our country. The time is now to take on the powerful special interests in the insurance and pharmaceutical industries and pass single-payer national health care program. The website to sign his petition is Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S, .senate.gov. Conversely, if you think single-payer is a bad idea and prefer to support the insurance and pharmaceutical industries while having the most expensive and wasteful health care system of any industrial nation on the planet, you could write him and tell him that. You won't be alone. Corporate media would seem to agree with you. Has anybody else noticed that Iran just had a presidential election that was accused of being fraudulent, and the people poured out into the streets of the capital in protest? And compare that to the United States, which had two recent presidential elections rife with fraud and stolen, obviously stolen, and the people did virtually nothing. What's wrong with this picture? Next item. NPR also had an interesting puff piece in the fact that the Iraqi Air Force is in disarray and the American conquerors are not making its resurgence a priority. The whole piece was predicated on the amazing assumption that Iraq needs an Air Force in the first place. All I got from it was that a bunch of Iraqi pilots have no planes to fly. The piece was based on the absurd premise that, of course, Iraq needs an Air Force, because all the nations surrounding them all had Air Forces. Well, yes, Iran has an Air Force, so does Turkey, and I suppose Syria and Jordan could put a few planes in the air, but so what? Iraq needs a police force for stability inside its country, not an Air Force. To counter that absurd position, there was no mention of the fact that Costa Rica not only doesn't have an Air Force, they haven't had any military at all for 60 years, and they've survived quite nicely, thank you, while surrounded by nations that were and are continuing to waste vast sums on their standing armies and air forces. However, do not despair. The piece ended with the heartening news that both the French and American defense industries were in the process of signing contracts to remedy this tragic situation, and soon Iraq will be squandering what little of its wealth remains on refurbishing its air force. As Travis T. Hipp is fond of saying, sometimes I wonder, other times I'm sure. But if I insist on tuning in to NPR, I guess I deserve what I hear. Next item. For those patriots who firmly believe that torture is only done to terrorists, this might cause pause for thought. The article's by Sean O'Neill, crime editor of the Times of London. London's Metropolitan Police accused of waterboarding cannabis suspects. The Times has learned that according to allegations at the center of a major anti-corruption inquiry, Metropolitan Police officers subjected suspects to waterboarding. The torture claims are part of a wide-ranging investigation which also includes accusations that officers fabricated evidence and stole suspects' property. It has already led to the abandonment of a drug trial and the suspension of several police officers. The waterboarding claims will fuel the debate about police conduct that has raged in the wake of hundreds of public complaints of brutality at the anti-G20 protests in April. The part of the inquiry focusing on alleged police brutality has been taken over by the Independent Police Complaints Commission. It is examining the conduct of six officers connected to drug raids in November, in which four men and a woman were arrested at addresses in Enfield and Tottenham. Police said they found large amounts of cannabis, and the suspects were charged with importation of a Class C drug. The case was abandoned 4 months later when the Crown Prosecution Service said it would not have been in the public interest to proceed. It is understood that the trial, by revealing the torture claims, would have compromised the criminal investigation into the six officers. My comment. I'm not familiar with British law, but I must assume that any statements made by these drug offense suspects while being waterboarded would not be allowed into court. That might be another reason for the charges being dropped. So what's the take-home lesson of this story? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Give sadists with uniforms, guns, and badges the chance to torture, and they just might do so. First, we torture suspected terrorists. Next, we torture suspected drug dealers. Next, we torture you. Get ready, Americans. The chickens will come home to roost. Next item. Based on 144 deaths, the United Nations declared that a swine flu pandemic has begun. Politicians prepare mass vaccination programs with payment of billions for drug companies that have lobbied for such laws. 500,000 people die each year from ordinary flu, but no pandemic declared for that. Media carries the story without challenge. The story is by Maria Chang and Frank Jordans, Associated Press writers, first published in Boston.com. Swine flu pandemic has begun. It's the first declared pandemic in 41 years. Swine flu is now formally a pandemic, a declaration by UN health officials that will speed vaccine production, and spur government spending to combat the first global flu epidemic in 41 years. Thursday's announcement by the World Health Organization doesn't mean the virus is any more lethal, only that its spread is considered unstoppable. Since it was first detected in late April in Mexico and the United States, swine flu has reached 74 countries, infecting nearly 29,000 people. Most who catch the bug have only mild symptoms and don't need medical treatment. Let me repeat those statistics. They say it's infected over 29,000 people, and there's been 144 deaths. Back to the article. For many weeks, U.S. health officials have been treating it as a pandemic, increasing the availability of antiviral flu medicines and pouring money into a possible vaccination program. But while this semi-panic is taking place, scientists have grown to understand that the virus is generally not that much more severe than the seasonal flu. But now that a pandemic has been declared, some countries might be prompted to devote more money to containing the virus. Many developed countries have pandemic preparedness plans that link spending to a WHO declaration. My comment. Those of you playing the stock market might want to check out which big pharmaceutical corporations are busily making swine flu vaccines. Some people are going to make a killing off of this non-story. If you are greedy and ethically challenged, this may be your big chance. The time is 12:25. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing, and your host is Chamberlain. This article might tie into the swine flu story. It's by Fred Reed. He writes a blog called Fred on Everything. Technology is good for you. I've decided that I support the exploration of Mars. I want to go first and hide there in a sealed spacesuit. I was boring myself to death in one of those diabolical exercise machines at Gold's Gym and in desperation reading Scientific American, a magazine of left-wing politics and occasional science. I ran across a small blurb about Eckhard Wimmer of the State of University of New York at Stony Brook. He and some other folks had just built artificial poliovirus, said Scientific American, starting with mail-order chemicals. And it worked. It infected mice, which is just really interesting. In fact, it's scary. First, you have to think what a virus is. Basically, it's a long strand of DNA or RNA. Some viruses are long, loose strands, like Ebola. Some ball into a glob and have protein coats around them. At bottom, they're strands of ribonucleic acids, the stuff that tells cells what to do. DNA is a sort of double chain of little chemical building blocks called nucleotides. The details aren't critical here. The important thing is that everybody in biochemistry understands nucleotides, and they're widely available. They're not evil. They're like nails. You can buy them. Think of them as beads on strings. They come in four colors, so to speak. Cytosine, guanine, adenine, and thymine. Okay, and uracil and RNA. The language is technoglop, but the point is that if you string them together in the same order as natural DNA, the result is indistinguishable from natural DNA. Maybe you're thinking, so what, Fred? Why are you doing this to me? Do I look like a chemistry geek? Okay, wait a paragraph or two. Many viruses have been sequenced. That is, we know what the order of nucleotides is in them. Professor Wimmer, to show what bioterrorists might do, downloaded the sequence for polio from the Internet and built the virus, using chemicals you can get from a biological supply house. When he injected it into the brains of mice, a mental note to self, don't be a mouse, the beast duly got polio. The artificial strain wasn't as virulent as the natural variety, but it did function. Why is this important? Because it means that you don't need a culture of a virus to release it into the world. In principle, all you need is the DNA sequence and some lab equipment that is getting better by the week. Then you can build viruses on your own. Think psychotic graduate students. Putting it otherwise, any virus whose sequence is known isn't extinct. Further, when people can build viruses from sequences, governments cannot have monopolies on sequenced viral pathogens. Today, in various journals of military affairs, you see assertions that smallpox, officially pronounced extinct many years ago, does exist in labs in Russia, maybe in England and in America. People express concern that it might somehow escape or get into the hands of terrorists. But if viruses can be strung together like Tinker toys, it doesn't matter whether these countries have a sequenced virus. Anybody, for too long, will be able to make it. Being the endlessly dutiful reporter that I am, I got onto the horn to Stony Brook to check out the story. Left a message with a PR woman and never heard back. Maybe Professor Wimmer's next project can be to synthesize a functioning PR woman. Judging by comments on the web from members of Wimmer's team, smallpox would be trickier to make than polio and maybe impossible today. But molecular biology is just booming along. Now, get on Google and search on smallpox and sequencing. Bingo. Quote, although the complete genomic sequence of selected isolates of variola virus is known, blah, blah, blah. Smallpox is 30% fatal. It's also highly contagious, as anthrax is not. If your population is 300 million, that's about 100 million dead. Those who don't die end up looking as if they had. Nobody's much vaccinated these days. Incredibly infective vectors for viral transmission today exist. The major one's called a Boeing 747. The public health system could not remotely handle so many patients. It's worth thinking about. I'm just a working stiff columnist. I don't get paid for cosmic truth. But Mars makes more and more sense. My comment. Well, that's something to keep in mind with all of this Homeland Security nonsense. How secure are we if anybody can go on the web and get the DNA sequences for some of these nasty things, then go out and buy some lab equipment and make the stuff? It stands to reason that terrorists can infect whole populations. They don't even need bombs, dirty bombs, clean bombs, that sort of thing. Okay, here's some more Fred Reed. I love the guy. He's got about as good a take on corporate media news as anybody I've read, and he manages to laugh at it. Would that I could do the same. Here's his latest. He calls it Mowing the Sword of Damocles, subtitled, I have no idea what I meant by that. I've been reading the news again. It's great fun, like watching an EEG trace as it slowly flatlines. Reading a newspaper increasingly reminds me of watching a leper to see which finger falls off next. You can make bets. In the news, I find more on torture. I'm so proud. Home of the brave, land of the free, though we may pull your fingernails out. What nobody talks about is where we get our torturers. I mean, is it a rating? Like radioman first class? Do recruiting officers offer it? What civilian applications do they see when an eager young Torquemadi leaves the military? Local police? The question of recruiting is fascinating. How much would you have to be paid to crush knees with a sledgehammer? Where do they find these guys? The boss at Langley presumably doesn't just walk through the office saying, hey, we need someone TDY for Guantanamo to crush genitals. Sally, you up for it? Bill, you get overseas pay and it looks good on your resume. Or does he? The military didn't have any trouble getting those girl soldiers at Abu Ghraib into it. Ooh, ka-ching. Kinky. Sadism is sexual. People don't do it who don't like it. We're not talking fun and games amongst suburban S&M hobbyists who like to spank each other. Don't even think about what goes on in Saudi prisons in league with the American military. Do our twisted patriots spend a few hours breaking some poor kid's mind and then rush into an adjoining room to masturbate? Do they swap techniques? Next, I see that some guy named Ahmed Dinner Jacket claims he's been elected president of Iran again. It seems that he's being threatened by the Prime Minister of Israel, who for some time I believe to be named Bibi Netanyahu. This struck me as unusually candid. Why don't I care? Sounds like a personal problem. If they nuked each other, the planet would be so much quieter. Meanwhile, North Korea threatens South Korea with nuclear war, and the U.S. pledges noisily to defend the South at all costs. Why? The South has lots more population and industry than does the North. If South Korea wants to defend itself, it can. If it doesn't want to, I don't care. I'm not Seoul's mother. When you enlist in the military, you pledge to defend the Constitution. Is it in Korea? I didn't pay much attention in high school civics. Next, I see that the U.S. has killed 13 more civilians with drone strikes in Afghanistan. Lovely. What fun. I picture some wet-lipped CIA psychopath goobering at a screen in search of someone to blow up. It's a cinch they don't know who they're aiming at. The CIA has never been very good at intelligence, but it doesn't matter. It's the spirit of the thing. Besides, Afghans breed like flies. If you spatter one kid with a really neat drone, got buttons, got knobs. They can beget another. Next, California's broke. Good. They deserve it. It's not as if bankruptcy were an act of God, like getting hit on the head by a giant meteor. It was deliberate stupidity. Spend more than you make, and you end up on the street. I'm supposed to feel sorry for that? I've known roundworms with better sense. As I understand it, the Democrats refuse to cut spending, and the Republicans refuse to raise taxes. See? A lobotomy in two-part harmony. Sounds like the whole country. Next, I see that President Obama wants to take on the pharmaceutical companies to lower the price of prescriptions. The subhead alleged that important congressmen have ties to the industry, as if this were somehow not right or normal. Okay, a brief excursion into cosmic truth. First, socialism. Hardline conservatives with little grasp of economics refer to anything they don't like, Hillary, national health care, regulation of anything that might cost them money, as socialist. It's a utility pejorative devoid of meaning, as racist and elitist are for political southpaws. Socialism is, of course, a system in which the government owns the means of production. Check your dictionary. Ah, but in America, the means of production owns the government. Inverted socialism it is. Here's a far better thing. If you are a means of production, anyway. Example. Bausch & Lomb makes ophthalmic salt water, useful in treating corneal edema, under the trade name Muro. In the Yankee capital, it costs $23 for 1.8 ounces. In Winchester, Virginia, $19. In Farmacias Guadalajara, about $6. The identical product. The generic here in Mexico, Hypoton, comes in at about $3. You could call it price fixing, but I prefer to think of it as government regulation of prices. It is perfectly legal because Big Pharma owns the government. I believe that economic textbooks say that price controls haven't worked from Diocletian on. Wrong. They work splendidly. Ask Bausch & Lomb. If you could make over $22 on a dime's worth of salt water, wouldn't you be in favor of government interference in the economy? Let me explain medicine briefly. It's an unholy scam. Here in Mexico, my wife occasionally gets ear infections. At any pharmacy, we pick up amoxicillin, 250 milligrams three times a day for 10 days. Cost $6. Recently, we were staying in Maryland with friends and she got an earache. Amoxicillin is by prescription only in the U.S., which means that doctors have a monopoly on earaches. It was Friday evening. It was either agony until Monday or go to one of those mall-based walk-in clinics, which wanted $150 for the appointment and prescribed $76 for the medicine. It's a scam, pure and simple. Above the level of county government, the U.S. is as corrupt as Mexico could ever be, and it's mostly legal. Yes, I know all the crap from doctors about engendering resistant bugs. Funny. Any pharmacist in Thailand will tell you the same thing a U.S. doctor will. Amoxicillin. Take all 10 days' worth, etc. It's a scam. Finally, I find that Northrop has unveiled an unmanned fighter, the X-47, I think. Unveiled is a curious word suggesting a blushing virgin. Again, it's inverse socialism. America has no military enemies, and the country is going broke, but the means of production own the government, and so we'll get the things at some huge cost. Northrop is picking the pocket of the corpse as it begins to decompose. Reminds me of Wall Street, government by looters. That's Fred Reed with his take on the news. Okay, let's talk about jury nullification. This article is from the ragblog.blogspot.com. Peers refuse to convict disabled vet in a pot bust. And he begins with a quote from Alexander Hamilton in 1804. Alexander Hamilton was one of the gentlemen created the government we're living under, so presumably he had some understanding of what he was doing. Quote, "Jurors should acquit, even against the judge's instruction, if exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction that the charge of the court is wrong." That's Alexander Hamilton. Okay, here's the article. Maybe this is how the war on marijuana ends. A rural Illinois jury has found one of their peers innocent in a marijuana case that could have sent him to prison. Lauren Swift was charged with possession of marijuana with intent to deliver, and he faced a mandatory minimum of 6 years behind bars. According to Jen Turney at My Web Times, several jurors were seen shaking Swift's hands after the verdict. A couple of them were talking and laughing with him and his lawyer, and one juror slapped Swift on the back. The 59-year-old was arrested after officials from a state drug task force found 25 pounds of pot and 50 pounds of growing plants in his home back in 2007. The Vietnam veteran walks with a cane, has bad knees and feet, and says he uses marijuana to relieve body pain, as well as to help cope with post-traumatic stress disorder. The jury exercised their rights of jury nullification. Judges and prosecutors never tell you this, but when you serve on a jury, it's not just the defendant on trial, it's the law as well. If you don't like the law and think applying it in this particular case would be unjust, then you don't have to find the defendant guilty, even if the evidence clearly indicates guilt. In jury nullification, a jury in a criminal case effectively nullifies a law by acquitting a defendant, regardless of the weight of evidence against him or her. There's intense pressure within the legal system to keep this power under wraps. But the fact of the matter is that when laws are deemed unjust, there is the right of the jury not to convict. Jury nullification is crucially important because until our national politicians show some backbone on the issue of marijuana law reform, it's one of the only ways to avoid imposing hideously cruel mandatory minimum penalties on marijuana users who don't deserve to go to prison. Prosecuting and jailing people for marijuana wastes valuable resources, including court and police time and tax dollars. Hundreds of thousands of otherwise productive, law-abiding people have been deprived of their freedom, their families, their homes, and their jobs. Let's save the jails for real criminals, not pot smokers. The American public is very near the tipping point, where a majority no longer believes the official line coming from drug warrior politicians and their friends at the ONDCP, gung-ho narcotics officers protecting their profitable turf, and sensationalistic, scaremongering news stories used to boast ratings. They are starting to see through the widening cracks in the wall of denial when it comes to marijuana's salutary medical effects on a host of illnesses and its palliative effects for the terminally ill and permanently disabled. People are coming to realize that not only have they been sold a lie when it comes to marijuana, they've been sold a particularly cruel lie, a self-perpetuating falsehood of epic proportions that has controlled U.S. public policy towards the weed for 70 years now. The extreme cruelty of the lies told about marijuana by drug warriors is in the effects this culture of fear and intolerance has in the real world, effects like long prison sentences for gentle people who are productive and caring members of society. Because citizens are coming to this long-delayed realization, we're going to be seeing more and more cases like this where juries have chosen not to punish people for pot. As this consciousness permeates all levels of society, it's going to get harder and harder for prosecutors to get guilty verdicts in marijuana cases. And that's a good thing. Maybe this is how the war in marijuana ends, not with a bang, but with a whimper. What you can do. If you ever serve on a jury where the defendant is accused of a marijuana crime, don't forget about jury nullification. Tell the other jurors you don't have to convict, even if all the evidence points to guilt, if you don't agree with the application of the law in this instance. And if you can't swing your peers to your way of thinking, at least you can cause the jury to return a hung verdict. My comment. California is in a perpetual budget crisis, not just this year, every year. Governor Arney is proposing massive cuts in social services, but the prison industry seems impervious to budget cuts. No politician nor corporate media has the cojones to mention how much prison space and court time we waste on nonviolent cannabis drug law offenders. Wipe out marijuana crimes and we would need less prisons, less prison guards, and save bundles of money. A sensible solution to our budget crisis? Don't hold your breath. Just like single-payer health care, it's a sensible solution, but not a politically expedient one. What's wrong with this picture? A final comment. The tide is changing. Rumor has it that the local district attorney is reluctant to bring many simple cannabis cases to court as local juries refuse to convict. The people seem to be speaking, and our elected officials seem to be reluctantly listening. Would that this phenomenon were repeated on a state and national level. And we have a call. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
I wanted to say about the notification that if you're going to try to get on a jury like that and exercise that right, you need to be stealth about it because they won't let you if they think you might.
Oh, okay, very good point. So if you're going to serve on a jury and they have the preliminary questioning of jurors, you don't want to mention that you believe in jury nullification. Thank you for that. Okay. Another article on jury nullification. Barry Cooper of Texas declared that he's running for Texas Attorney General as a Libertarian. In addition to continuing to run reverse sting operations on corrupt police, he's recently taken a hard stance in defense of proper common law jury trials and the right of jurors to vote their consciences. Of course, most people are not fully aware of the way in which we have lost our right to a proper jury trial, so some further explanation is needed. A common law jury contains jurors who understand that once seated, they are superior in power to the judge and prosecutor. Even one such juror is enough to hang a jury, providing a way for strong-willed individuals to limit unjust state punishment. So how do we get this information into the minds of the jurors where it needs to be? Simple. We hand jury rights pamphlets to incoming jurors. By educating people who have shown up to the courthouse as prospective jurors, we're waging a war of information against tyranny on its home turf. Is it risky? Yes, it is. Judges will typically send out police to threaten jury rights activists with arrest. Therefore, it's a good thing that there are people like Barry Cooper and his team of copbusters who are willing to do it for us. Barry rigidly adheres to the Freedom Force creed of freedom. The message of jury power is damaging to collective tyranny, but benign to justice, even if Barry remains unelected. With every person who learns their power as a juror, we're closer to a rule of law that will refuse to convict individuals of breaking the legal tender laws. Such knowledge, once popularized and decentralized, could well mean the death of the most monstrous creature. Quote by Thomas Jefferson, I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet devised by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its Constitution. A quote by Henry David Thoreau, if the machine of government is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say break the law. If this man's campaign to be Attorney General of Texas, if that interests you, you can contact him or contribute at www.electbarrycooper.com. There was a phone call. Okay, it's gone. To those of you who would like to phone in, the numbers are 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. However, keep in mind that if I'm in the middle of reading an article, I'm going to finish the article before I get to your call, so you have to be patient. Or you don't have to be patient. That's up to you. Okay, this one is by Greg Pallast, and he's writing for Air America's radio Ring of Fire. It's called Oil and Indians Don't Mix. There's an easy way to find oil. Go to some remote and gorgeous natural sanctuary, say Alaska or the Amazon, find some Indians, and then drill under them. If the indigenous folk complain, well, just shoo them away. Shooing methods include bulldozers, bullets, crooked politicians, and fake land sales. But be aware, lately the natives are shooing back. Last week, indigenous Peruvians seized an oil pumping station, grabbed the 9 policemen guarding it, and, say reports, executed them. This followed the government's murder of more than a dozen rainforest residents who had protested the seizure of their property for the oil drilling. Again and again, I see it in my line of work of investigating fraud. Here are a few pit stops on the oil trail of tears. In the 1980s, Charles Koch was found to have pilfered about $3 worth of crude from Stanley Ann Madigan's oil tank in Oklahoma. Here's the weird part. Koch was and remains the 14th richest man on the planet, worth about $14 billion. Stanley Ann was a dirt-poor Osage Indian. Stanley Ann wasn't Koch's only victim. According to secret tape recordings of a former top executive of his company, Koch Industries, the billionaire demanded that oil tanker drivers secretly siphon a few bucks worth of oil from every tank attached to a stripper well on the Osage Reservation, where Koch had a contact to retrieve crude oil. Koch, according to the tape, would giggle with joy over the records of the theft. Koch's own younger brother, Bill, ratted him out, complaining that, in effect, brothers Charles and David cheated him out of his fair share of the looting, which totaled over $750 million from the native lands. The FBI filmed the siphoning with hidden cameras, but criminal charges were quashed after quiet objections from the Republican senators. Then there are the Chugach natives of Alaska. The port of Valdez, Alaska, is arguably one of the most valuable pieces of real estate on Earth, the only earthquake-safe, ice-free port in Alaska that could load oil from the giant North Slope field. In 1969, Exxon and British Petroleum companies took the land from the Chugach and paid them $1. I kid you not. Wally Hinkle, then the former governor of Alaska, dismissed at my suggestion that the Chugach deserved a bit more respect and cash for their property. Quote, "Land ownership comes in two ways, Mr. Palast," explained the governor and pipeline magnate, "purchase or conquest. The fact that your granddaddy chased a caribou across land doesn't make it yours." By the way, the Chugach have lived there for over 3,000 years. No oil company would dream of digging on the Bush family properties in Midland, Texas, without paying a royalty, or drilling near Malibu without the latest in environmental protections. But when natives are on top of Exxon's or BP's glory hole, suddenly the great defenders of private property rights turn quite Bolshevik. Lands can be seized for the public's need for oil. Some natives are relocated through legal flimflams, some at gunpoint. The less lucky are left to wallow, literally, in the gunk left by the drilling process. Take a look at this photo here, taken in the Amazon rainforest in Ecuador. It's from an investigation that I conducted for BBC TV, now in the film Palace Investigates. I'm holding up a stinking black gop of crude oil residue pulled from an abandoned Chevron Texaco waste pit. A pipe runs from that toxic pit right into the water supply of Cofan Indians. Chief Carrillo told me how oil company executives helicoptered into his remote village, and speaking in Spanish, which the Cofan don't understand, quote, purchased drilling rights with trinkets and cheese. The natives had never seen cheese. The cheese tasted smelled funny, so we threw it in the jungle. After drilling began, Cirillo's son went swimming in his usual watering hole, came up vomiting blood, and died. I asked Chevron about the wave of poisonings and deaths. According to an independent report, 14,000 deaths, mostly of children, mostly from cancers, can be traced to Chevron's toxic dumping. Chevron's lawyer told me, quote, "And it's the only case in the world of cancer in the world? How many cases of children with cancer do you have in the States? They have to prove that it was our crude," close quote, which he noted with glee, is absolutely impossible. Big oil treats indigenous blood like a cheap gasoline additive. That's why the Peruvians are up in arms. The Cofan of Ecuador, unlike their brothers in Peru, have taken no hostages. Rather, they have heavily armed themselves with lawyers. But Chevron and its big oil brethren remain dismissive of the law. This week, Shell Oil, to get rid of a nasty PR problem, by paying $15 million to the Ogoni people and the family of Ken Sarawiwo for the oil giant's alleged role in the killings of Wiwa and his associates, activists who had defended these Nigerian Delta people against drilling contamination. Shell pocketed $31 billion last year in profits and hopes the payoff will clear the way for a drilling partnership with the Nigerian government. Congratulations, Shell. $15 million for a license to kill and drill. That's quite a bargain. Let's see, we're running out of time. Here's the top 10 ways. Here's another perspective on health care in America. He calls it the top 10 ways to know if you're living in a medical police state. Authors Mike Adams, The Health Ranger, naturalnews.com. The instances cited are not theoretical. All the instances cited have actually occurred. Instance one, if an armed U.S. Marshal is posted outside your house at night just to make sure you don't escape treatment, you're probably living in a medical police state. If saying, "I'd rather not inject my child with that poison," to your doctor results in him calling Child Protective Services, you're probably living in a medical police state. If a nationwide manhunt involving FBI agents is unleashed just to find you and drag you back to the hospital to submit to dangerous pharmaceuticals, there's little doubt you're living in a medical police state. If you find yourself suddenly wondering if you should flee to Mexico in order to find freedom to seek medical treatment of your choice, you're probably living in a medical police state. If doctors call the police to prevent you from visiting competing cancer clinics outside the country, that's a warning sign. You're living in a police state, medical police state. If your doctor claims to be practicing in integrative medicine, but then calls the police when you don't submit to chemotherapy, you're definitely living in a medical police state. If you're blasted by the mainstream media for supporting a mother's right to protect her teenage son from an injection of toxic chemicals, you know the answer. If you walk into a hospital and they handcuff you, steal your child, and forcibly inject him with dangerous poisons while explaining it's for your own good, then you're living in a medical police state. If the state calls you medically negligent for feeding your child raw foods or medicinal herbs or holistic diets that are free from sugar, red meat, and chemical additives, then you're definitely living in a medical police state. Fact: parents who feed their children diets of raw living foods have been accused of medical neglect. And finally, if you disagree with your psychiatrist and in response he diagnoses you with an oppositional defiance disorder and demands you take his mind-altering psych drugs, you're absolutely living in a medical police state. Okay, a man stood in a metro station in Washington, D.C. and started to play the violin. It was a cold January morning. He played 6 Bach pieces for about 45 minutes. During that time, since it was rush hour, it was calculated that thousands of people went through the station, most of them on their way to work. 3 minutes went by, and a middle-aged man noticed there was music playing. He slowed his pace, stopped for a few seconds, and then hurried up to meet his schedule. A minute later, the violinist received his first dollar tip. A woman threw the money in the till and, without stopping, continued to walk. A few minutes later, someone leaned against the wall to listen to him, but the man looked at his watch and started to walk again. Clearly, he was late for work. The one who paid the most attention was a 3-year-old boy. His mother tagged him along, hurried, but the kid stopped to look at the violinist. Finally, the mother pushed hard, and the child continued to walk, turning his head all the time. This action was repeated by several other children. All the parents, without exception, forced them to move on. In the 45 minutes the musician played, only 6 people stopped and stayed for a while. About 20 gave him money, but continued to walk their normal pace. He collected $32. When he finished playing and silence took over, no one noticed it. No one applauded, nor was there any recognition. No one knew this, but the violinist was Joshua Bell, one of the best violinists in the world. He played one of the most intricate pieces ever written for a violin, with a violin worth $3.5 million. 2 days before his playing in the subway, Joshua Bell sold out a theater in Boston, and the seats averaged $100. This is a true story. Joshua Bell playing incognito in the metro station was organized by the Washington Post as part of a social experiment about perception, taste, and priorities of people. The outlines were, in a commonplace environment and at an inappropriate hour, do we perceive beauty? Do we stop to appreciate it? Do we recognize the talent in an unexpected context? One of the possible conclusions from this experience could be, if we do not have a moment to stop and listen to one of the best musicians in the world playing some of the best music ever written, how many other things are we missing? Okay, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Chris Kelly with Bike Talk. Discussing things as they are said to be. Said one to the other. Now listen, you two. The circle room.